Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It would entirely eliminate state, local, and federal corporate personal income taxes, capital gains taxes, sales taxes, gift and estate taxes, and it would replace them with a very simple flat tax rate on all transactions.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Well, on the last podcast, Ben asked whether we could look into the work of Edgar Feige, who proposed a simpler tax, an automated transaction tax, a small amount of tax on every transaction. Easy to find, hard to avoid, as a replacement to the complex tax system that every country has built up over the years. But would it work? We look at the pros and cons of that this week, and a couple of pieces of listener feedback at the end today as well. So stay tuned for that. It's the Debunking Economics Podcast. So Edgar Feige, he was a graduate of Columbia University. He was actually taught by Milton Friedman, apparently. As I said last week, let's not hold that against him. He is an advocate of an automated payment transaction tax, the idea that we get rid of all taxes, so sales tax, income tax, corporate excise, capital gains, import and export duties, inheritance tax, all of those go and they all get replaced with a tax on all transactions. So every transaction out, every transaction in has a small tax on it. And I guess the number one advantage of that, Steve, I can see lots of holes in this, even though, you know, there's, I think all of those holes will have been explored by now, of course. But one advantage is, obviously, it is very broad-based. No avoiding it.
That's partly the issue, because income tax, it's very easy to avoid it if you're wealthy. And that's one of the great drawbacks that occurred with the whole income tax approach to raising, not to raising revenue, but, you know, if you look at it in terms of the accurate accounting of government finances, it's taking out excess money creation by the government out of circulation. But if you're taking it out of the pockets of the working class and the middle class, you get the right-wing backlash and you get redneck Republicans who don't want to, all they see is the money coming out of their accounts, the taxation. They don't see the spending that goes in the other side to some degree, but most of the money gets accumulated by the wealthy who put the money in offshore havens and therefore what they're actually doing is skimming off the financial system of the government and calling it enterprise.
Yeah, I wonder whether this has actually fixed that problem, though, but we'll come back to that in a moment. But it's obviously the question is, it's a question of, let's address this one first of all. Do you need to collect any tax? And I think you do, don't you? Because you need that control mechanism. If you accept the fact, because there'll be people who would say, well, no, you don't, because we're MMTers and we believe that, you know, the government can spend, it doesn't have to worry about taxation. But you...
Hang on a second. I better dive in there before
you get jumped on. I was going to say, the second half of the sentence was, you do need that controlling mechanism, because it's your way of controlling how much money there is in circulation.
Well, then this relates to the history of the scale of the government in advanced economies as well, because the usual story, we think what we've got used to has always been the rule. You know, in fact, if you go back to the pre-Great Depression and pre-Second World War level of spending by the American government, again, we have all this image of, every 19th century show you see has got, it may have gunslingers, but it's also got the cavalry and the sheriff, et cetera, et cetera. And you would imagine the scale of government spending relative to GDP was the same then as it is now, anything but. It's about 1/6 the level. So government spending was of the order of, say, 5% of GDP rather than 30%. Now, if you're running 5% of GDP, as your total expenditure, then your deficit component of that can be actually quite small. Mm. And in fact, unfortunately, for most of the 19th century, just like now, the American government was obsessed with getting its debt down. So it was actually normally running surpluses and eliminating money rather than creating it. But if you're at that level, you can do without broad-based taxation, because if you're only spending in 5% to have the same level of deficit spending now, you need to tax 3% of GDP, not 30% of GDP. And therefore, you can get by with excise taxes, land taxes, a range of smallish transaction taxes, and so on. And that then keeps the level of government spending, of money creation through government spending, below 2 or 3% of GDP, which is about the level you would need for an economy growing at the rate the 19th century American economy was. Now, fast forward to today, you're running at six times that scale. That would mean 30. Roughly speaking, government spending around the world is of the order of 30% or more of GDP. If you spent 30% in and didn't tax any of it back, you'd have your money supply growing by 30%, roughly speaking. Yeah. And so you've got to tax.
Yeah, you have to tax. And tax becomes a controlling mechanism for how much money there is in circulation. I guess if you've got a very small transaction tax, and it's easy for you to change that because it's a simple tax that's applied everywhere. So I don't know what it is. Say it's 0.5%. And you go, we're running, there's too much money in circulation. We need to pull it back. You could say, well, okay, we're going to make it 0.6%. And all of a sudden, that's enacted everywhere. So it as a fine-tuning instrument, it could be a good thing, couldn't it?
In that sense, it's much easier to manipulate than the income tax. Again, because it's imposed upon us individually, and we've got to pay it out individually, and it is a pain in the butt for everybody paying tax to have to go through the whole process of, toting up your income and then looking at what the government's already taken out when you have, pay-as-you-go type taxation. It's a nuisance. It irritates people, and they see the negative money coming out of their account. They don't see the positives that existed there as well from government spending causing part of the money that turns up in their bank accounts. You're on a hiding to nothing to turn the populist right wing. In other words, anti-government spending, by taking the money out through income tax rather than taking it out through some more neutral mechanism. And the last thing you can do is say, the inflation's up, we're going to increase your tax rate. I can't see that being a vote winner somehow.
Yeah. But actually, that is the answer, isn't it? I mean, that's
the argument made is that if inflation becomes a problem, then we can increase the tax rate. But if you do that, I mean, people would be suffering doubly. This is why I think it's politically untenable to imagine you can adjust income tax rates as a way of controlling inflation. You could adjust transaction tax rates because they're so much smaller and they're not imposed on the individual who then finds out exactly, how much money the government's taking out of my finances. So I think in that sense, transaction taxes are, if you are going to use taxation to try to reduce the rate of inflation, then it's far less politically dynamite to increase the small rate of a transaction tax than it would be to increase the large rate of an income tax, particularly when given the capacity of the wealthy to finance, pay for accountants and lawyers who can disguise where their earnings go and take their earnings offshore as well. It's just, to me, it's a nightmare to imagine you could adjust those income tax rates. But transaction tax is much more feasible.
So, let's keep on the inflation theme just for a second, because, of course, that is the idea of, central banks. Monetary policy is supposedly there to try and control spending and how much money is in circulation. That's the theory. That's what monetary theory is supposedly all about. With this, you wouldn't need them, would you? You'd just say, the government can be in control of this because if we're looking at money supply, it's just tax. That's the instrument we're going to use.
Yeah.
Don't worry about interest rates.
Well, the interest rate, this is something we should maybe spend another podcast on at some point. But clearly, interest rates weren't what reduced inflation when interest rates were going up. It's a classic case of correlation, not causation, which you can identify by taking a look at as we spoke about recently, Japan, for the whole period of the post-COVID inflation. inflation until just recently. Japan had a policy interest rate of minus 0.1%. And now it's gone up to, what is it 0.1? I keep forgetting.
But it's zero. Yeah, it's gone from minus 0.1 to zero, basically. Yeah.
Okay, look. And across that time, the rate of increase in inflation was lower in Japan compared to the average than most of the rest of the world, certainly less than America and the UK. And its recovery was about the same speed. So by doing nothing about interest rates, Japan controlled inflation. By doing lots about interest rates, American and English mainstream economists think they controlled the rate of inflation. I'm sorry, guys, you just imposed pain on the pain on the populace who saw their commercial rates of interest rise because of that, and pleasure on the financial sector because you gave them a larger amount of money from their bonds, while combining with neuroticism by making, you know, reducing the value of their existing bonds and making it rather dangerous to have too many bonds in the mark-to-market category and not enough in the hold to maturity. So it's a classic. Yeah, you know, we don't have a mechanism to control the rate of inflation. We do have central banks modifying interest rates in the belief they're doing
so
it.
So simplicity all around in this approach, isn't there? I think there are downsides. We will come to those. But another upside, the tax office. Hey, sorry, guys, you're going to have to find another job. because EVD is simply applied automatically on every single transaction. Presumably that's something that can be automated through the banking system. You might avoid it through using cash, but to be honest, it's going to be such a small level of tax, it's not going to be worth your while. So it would literally just be a tax through banks.
Yeah. And
all those thousands of people in the tax office busy looking at who's trying to dodge tax and how they're going to charge you and how they're going to, you know, and all the interest payments they charge you on late payments, all that sort of stuff just disappears.
Yeah. And this is, I mean, something which we're getting down into the fine issues now about tax, because we in general say the government doesn't tax to spend, it spends and then taxes. And the MMT argument, which I'm moderately sympathetic with, I'm not a great fan of it, is that the imposition of taxation is what makes the money valuable in the first place. I think the actual position is money is valuable because it's money. It's a form of even if when government taxation is quite small, and you can see that again looking at the 19th century American case. Some people had to pay taxes some of the time, but the vast majority of the population certainly wasn't sitting down working out their tax return at the end of the financial year because they didn't have income tax. So the money system was still effective even without taxation being imposed on the individual. And the same would apply here. Paying a transaction tax on the money you had would be one of the characteristics of money. It wouldn't be something that you could decide to opt out from.
The thing as well about VAT, we have a tax on transactions now when we buy something, but in the UK, it's 20%. And you'd have to think, and, you know, okay, with the usual caveat about, well, how much do we want to encourage consumption? But in the system that we're using today, that's what it's all about. 20% VAT. I mean, I just know from my own personal behavior, there's something I want to buy and I look and I go, oh, that price is without VAT. Oh, it's a bit much when you add 20%. I'm not going to buy it. I mean, it is an inhibitor to sales.
Yeah, it is. And that's again because it is such a big, you're just taxing that one component. When you consume, the thing is gone. We don't have taxations on financial transactions. We have the banks charging fees on that sort of thing, but we don't have the government charging taxation on it. So it means that when we face income tax or VAT, they're big numbers, big chunks, and we can see them going out of our wallets. Transaction taxes, which would be, let's get the guy's idea here, but a substantially lower percentage each time, you wouldn't notice it, and it would be the number of times on which it was done, because it hits every transaction, rather than the amount it is on a final transaction, yeah, which is the role of VAT.
Well, Dr. Feige reckons in 2005, he did the sums, if the US wanted to get the same amount of income from tax, to get the same level from the tax returns, then each, and using a transaction tax, each transaction would just be 0.3%. So no one's going to feel that by and large.
No, by and large. And this is like a way in effect of imposing entropy upon money, because one of the points that physicists make about the everything in the real world is that waste is inevitable. Everything degrades. The second law of thermodynamics means that when you use energy to do work, you necessarily generate waste, and the waste exceeds the amount of work you manage to isolate out. And by using that energy, and that's, I'm sure some physicists are going to jump on my throat on that one, but the basic idea, waste exceeds, the waste we generate exceeds the amount we call GDP. So we have this dilemma all the time, except for money. Money just accumulates and appreciates under our current system. And this is, I think, Soddy's point. The chemist who took a good look at economics and was quite horrified, he argued that money should depreciate. So in that sense, this is a bit like Azalean money as well. The money itself degrades with use, and therefore that itself addresses the issue of government spending being so great that without taking it out in some sense, you are going to cause a massive increase in the money supply, which would cause inflation ultimately, whether that's in consumer goods or in asset prices. So it's another way to attack the scale of government spending and the issue that creates with the scale of money creation.
But what about, if you've got money sitting for a long time? I mean, it's okay for transactions for, people who are using, participating in the economy on a daily basis. But I've got a swag of cash. I'm sitting somewhere. I've got it sitting in a house, for example, and I'm watching that house increase in value. And it goes from being worth 1 million to being worth 10 million. I sell it. I pay 0.3% tax on that 10 million property. So it's not helping with that wealth divide if someone isn't involved in transactions.
That's right. And that actually is the reason the Gazellian idea would be probably a complement to this concept, because the idea of the Gazellian was to actually tax the money you're not using that stays in your account, or it stays in, you're not being circulated as it was with the Gazellian physical currency. If it stays in your account, then it depreciates. And that's the other way to avoid, I don't think you just have the transaction cash. You'd also need to have something like what you'd call a hoarding tax, and again, people are always going to be trying to evade this. This is one of the attractions of Bitcoin, something that allegedly almost always appreciates, or buying shares and so on and so forth. Money, and this comes down to the nature of money. We often talk about, you see the definition of money in textbooks. It says it's a means of account, a means of exchange, and a store of value. And as Keynes wrote beautifully in The Great General Theory and a paper in 37 also called the General Theory of Employment, he says, we so are told without a smile on the face, but what only in a lunatic asylum would somebody hold money as a source of value, because a store of value, because everything else is supposed to rise in money in value, whereas money remains constant. So his point was that the store of value component of the standard definition of money is wrong. Okay, it is a misnomer to see it as a way of accumulation. Because if you simply accumulate money itself without buying other assets with it or without starting a business and so on, then it's barren. It doesn't give you any return. So what people are always looking for is a financial asset which is likely to rise in value or could rise in value. So they turn their money into shares or other forms of equity. So
shares would get hit by a transaction tax, but property wouldn't, because you're not involved in that day-to-day transaction.
But this is where we're now getting into the broad realm of taxes, and that's the Georgian argument. You should tax land.
Yeah, well, that was the second half of my sentence. Thank you for finishing off my sentences. But the problem with that then is,
because it seems like, what can I expect?
We've been doing this for too long, haven't we? So the but if you had the both of
you
them,
have you put your socks out?
Pardon me. I don't think we want to go here. We don't want to follow this line of
thought.
So if we've got a transaction tax day to day, and then we've got a land tax to stop people, the problem with that is, as you've just described, if you say, well, okay, you're going to get taxed on land as well. So if your land increases, you're going to be paying more tax based on your wealth. Then, just as you said, that money will then go somewhere else, and it'll go onto Bitcoin or some other tool that is a substitute for property, which is something where, wealth is accumulated, sits there, and people speculate up to the hilt, and everyone else is doing the same because they want to see the money increase. I don't know whether you can beat that that approach. That's just the way money flows.
That's one, again, one advantage of the idea of a transaction tax, because any of these financial transactions is, if you sell your property to try to evade paying the extra tax on the extra value, you'd probably tax X nonetheless, but anyway, you then have another, you've got everything you're converting, every transaction is going to be clipped to some degree. And it would still, when you think about the scale that's necessary, the 0.3% per transaction is quite low, but the number of times that's applied over transactions multiplies, whereas VAT is done in such a way that it's only allegedly only imposed once.
Well, so but I sell a house for $3 million and I pay 0.3% on that transaction. I buy Bitcoin or whatever else comes along to try and avoid land tax. I pay 0.3% in on that transaction for that $3 million. That $3 million sits there, suddenly becomes $6 million. I take it out and still only paying 0.3%. So there's a danger that it's going to force an accumulation of assets and really slow down the money supply.
Yeah, that's quite
the velocity
feasible.
Of money.
Yeah, and that again is one of the problems again about saving money. When you're trying to save money, what you're doing is you're slowing down the rate of turnover of money. You can't create it individually. So if individuals try to save more, each individual is slowing down the rate of turnover of the economy, and that was what Gazelle's idea was addressed at, to try to reverse that problem. So there is no easy way to do this, and you really would need to have a battery of ideas in place to try to bring it in, and it may well be you have unintended consequences.
Yeah, well, there are always unintended consequences. Well, let's look at some more of those when we come back after the break, because I think there's probably a million of them. I think it's a good idea, but whether it's an idea that can be done soulless and in isolation in one country as well, which is another question. So we'll look at that when we come back on the Debunking Economics podcast. It's me and Steve back in a second.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Well, this week we are looking at the idea from Edgar Feige from Columbia University. Well, that's where he studied anyway, about the idea of an automated payment transaction tax. The simplicity of the fact that every single transaction on your bank has what could be just as low as 0.3% tax, but that would apply to every single transaction. So actually, Steve, it wouldn't just be bank transactions, would it? It would have to be there, embedded into the finance system, because I pay money from my bank account into a share fund, a share portfolio. So do I pay the fund manager 0.3% on the whole transaction, and then he pays 0.3% on every single movement he makes on a daily basis? I guess that's the way it would work. It's going to hit algorithms hard, isn't it? It's going to hit high frequency trading.
Yeah. Well, this is an idea that was put forward ages ago by James Tobin, one of the more progressive neoclassical economists, and he argued that you'd use a transaction tax to slow down financial speculation, and that's the idea was to actually have a dramatic impact upon the level of speculation by putting a small tax, what he called putting sands in the grains of sand in the wheels of finance, and like that has always been a good idea, and you can tell how good an idea is by the extent to which the finance sector is fought against it. This would actually make it automatic, and that of course would mean that it's far less attractive to be, day trading may disappear. Oh, I'd be so sorry to see that go.
Well, I love the idea of whatever the asset class, It would trade, well, I don't know, two or three times a day, like, you know, like 9 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 5 o'clock, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And you know, you put your bids in, you put your top rate, your bottom rate, and you know, that transaction, it all happens at a set time. So you've got several hours to think about it. You can have a long lunch while you decide whether you're going to buy those shares or not, and you get rid of all of those. You know, a lot of that speculation, I think, would disappear.
Also, like, you know, like high frequency trading, for example, and I know from personal contact with people involved in this industry that it's basically front running, but front running, getting an absolutely tiny amount of gain out because you know what the bid, what the buy sell spread is, you know the order spread, and et cetera, and you get in there with the transaction speed, that would eliminate that particular source.
Which would be good, wouldn't it? Because I see, yeah. I do the podcast for the bank, and we're talking about, you know, data releases every day and how much that drives the market, and very often a report might come out and there's a headline figure and there's an immediate, you know, it might be a surprise, and there's an immediate response in the markets in whatever way, in bond yields or in currency exchange or whatever. There's an, you know, that immediate response because people have just seen the headline, and then they read the detail and they go, ah, okay, well, that's a bit different, you know, behind, you know, these numbers make a bit more sense, and all of a sudden there's a bounce back. And there's people who go, well, there probably is a bounce back, or I've read it first, or whatever. You've got actually people, and so you get the response. You've even got people, you know, paying vast amounts of money to get faster data links so that they can get this information a fraction of a second faster than everybody
gambling.
Else.
It's just nuts. I recommend anybody who haven't seen it, go, I think it's called An Honourable Gentleman, and go and see that. It's an Eddie Murphy movie involving a couple of brothers who make a $1 bet with each other, while at the same time they control the market for trading places. Trading places. Mm. Have a look at that movie. It's fabulous on that whole issue of tiny movements. And I have one little anecdote. One of my sisters was working as a secretary in a finance company at one stage, and she was because she's, you know, it was just a part-time job, so this is somebody with a, you know, honours degree typing away. And she asked one of the traders, what do you think is going to happen with the inflation numbers, to the movement today in some particular index? And the answer she got was, I don't care so long as it's big. And my sister's instant gut reaction was, that's immoral. Well, it is.
Yeah.
What you've got is something which is driven by gambling. You don't care what the number is, as long as it's a big change from what people expect. Therefore, you get plenty of volume of transactions, and on goes the madness of the finance sector.
So
anything to eliminate that would be a good idea.
And it's interesting how many people are in support of that idea, actually. Obviously not, as you say, the banks. In fact, there was a survey done. Some people call it the Robin Hood tax, don't they? A tax on every single financial transaction, whether it's stocks, bonds, currency exchanges, commodities, futures, options, any financial instrument, you'd pay a tax on that transaction. There's somebody campaigning for that, and I can't remember the full story on this, but they did an online survey to find out how many people supported the idea, and it came out roughly balanced. But when they did the analysis, they found that half of those people voting all came from one server in one merchant bank, funnily enough. So, but the people who support the idea, Angela Merkel, Nicolas Sarkozy, the former French president, George Soros, Warren Buffett. So there's some people with money who like this idea because it will stop algorithmic trading. It will stop all this speculation. So it's just a shame it's not happening, because that seems like a no-brainer. You know, take half of this transaction tax idea and just apply it to the finance sector.
Yeah. And like, the question is, how do you phase these sorts of things in? If you wanted to phase in a complete change to the income system, politically, it's just a nightmare. I can't see it actually ever being achieved. But you could try something of this nature on the finance sector. But of course, there, what you're going to get is, as you said, from one server, everybody in finance uniting against it, because there goes the honeypot. And like, the scale of it is something which most people have no real consciousness of. My favorite personal example, apart from knowing the company that does high frequency trading and knowing the scale of their operation and the technology they're putting in to take advantage of it, all of which is just crazy. The intriguing element was meeting up with a woman who was wife of a friend who worked in finance, and she explained she left to go become a school teacher because she became sick of what she was doing in finance. And she then explained that her paycheck as a teacher was 1/30th what her salary was in the finance sector. So that's like £750,000 a year rather than 25. But she said, and that's before the bonus, which normally doubled the salary. So there's incredible amounts of money being wasted on financial frivolity. And of course, they're going to fight tooth and nail to stop it coming in.
So back to Dr. Feige's idea, you know, of taking this further into transaction tax. I mean, we've already highlighted one issue that, you know, what does it do for people who are going to sit on wealth? You'd need some sort of wealth tax to sit alongside it. But also, I'm just wondering whether, you know, on the business side, businesses are going to get taxed less because a lot of these transactions are actually consumer transactions rather than business transactions. And smaller businesses might behave more like individuals, whereas big businesses will try and avoid these transaction taxes just by bringing more services in-house, so more vertical integration, so there's less transactions happening outside the business.
That is actually a damn good idea, frankly. It's quite intriguing. I think people are finally realizing what the horizontal integration of the last 40 or 50 years has done. You know, where you amalgamate a particular level of services, so one company takes over all of retail, you know, let's call it Amazon, for example, versus vertical integration, where you do everything internally. And in fact, the horizontal integration has destroyed the manufacturing capability of America because you outsource everything. This is partly where Boeing's problems have come from, because it's outsourced everything to reduce the labor cost. That was frankly what outsourcing was really about. And they therefore lose the internal skill base. And now we've got planes dropping out of the sky. You know, the old saying, if it's Boeing, I'm not going, is becoming the phrase. And that is a sign of the, in effect, the impact of the taxation system we have now. That's not the only motive by any means, but if you have a taxation system which lets people do as many transactions as they like, then you can get the financial obsession can take over how you run a company, and it becomes finance that drives manufacturing rather than vice versa. Mm. And that ends you up in hell, which is where we are now.
Yeah, and it's a lot less fuss, by the way, if you go with Airbus. I'm just finding the European argument there.
You made that up, or you've said
just
that
done
that
just now. I was racking my brains. I was half listening to what you were saying.
I'll be original.
Honest.
Okay.
Much
less fast to fly Airbus. Okay.
But you
better market that one to Airbus before somebody else.
Well, yeah, exactly. No, just one of the gems that you get listening to this podcast. Just spread the word. We'll give you advertising slogans and economic advice. Okay, great to have vertical integration. Not so great for small business that wants to supply to business. You know, there's a danger, isn't there, that it's going to cause this more accumulation of businesses. That vertical integration is great for those businesses, but not great for everybody else who wants to supply to them.
No, I think it actually could be easier for the smaller businesses because, I mean, I haven't had to fill out a business activity statement, a BAS. Mm. But the amount of bureaucracy involved in the taxation system is huge, as you were saying earlier.
Yeah.
So if you could reduce – just every transaction gets hit, it's just, you know – it's what you have to accept if you're going to go into business. You're going to be losing 0.3% every transaction. Big deal. It's better than having to have devoted accountants and trying to work out how to manipulate the tax code, which is what a huge part of the activities of companies now is around minimizing their tax liability rather than producing goods and services.
But the government, of course, uses as well tax to try and modify our behavior. Now, some people might say, well, they shouldn't be doing that. You know, so we shouldn't have a sugar tax. There should be, I shouldn't have got a tax benefit for buying an electric vehicle, which I've just, enjoyed. This idea that tax is used for government policy to try and change the way we behave, you wouldn't be able to do that with this sort of tax.
Well, the only one that I like it wasn't taxation that changed behavior on smoking. It was bans on it being done in public places. So I don't know how particularly effective those behavior modification elements were, including taxes on alcohol and so on. All this stuff is often used to fiddle the tax books by the government rather than actually being particularly effective. So I wouldn't be sorry to see that disappear either.
The only thing I don't like about it is the fact that Pauline Hanson thought it was a good idea. And for those who don't know, Pauline Hanson's a crazy... is she right-wing? I don't know. She's got the... anyway, she's a populist politician from Queensland. Not that smart. But she did latch onto this idea, didn't she, 10 or 15 years ago?
Yeah, well, you know, you can't choose your bedfellows sometimes.
That's all you got to say about it. So can you see any...
Well, that's all that she deserves being said about.
I would love to see whether Dr. Feige, when he came across this 0.3%, I'd love to see the income distribution, though, on that. I can't help feeling that it is not a particularly progressive tax. I feel as though... wealthy people are, you know, unless you have.
No, in fact, it is going to be behavioural modification in one way, because that, as you say, 0.3%, you wouldn't even, you look at a VAT, it's 20%. Look at a transaction, it's 0.3. You're not going to worry about it. So it's going to be less of a worry for individual consumers. But the part it's going to hit by far is the finance sector, because there are so many transactions that are involved in finance, you know, clipping pieces of paper and passing on to the next person in a money laundering scheme. You're not going to want to do that anymore. So it will have a huge behavioural impact upon the finance sector, right, which I think is a bloody good thing.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so all of those transactions disappear, then you have to start putting the transaction tax up from everyone else from perhaps 0.3% to 4%.
That's part of the... So if that has a desirable impact of reducing the level of transaction in the finance sector, you may be forced to raise the rate elsewhere. True.
Mm. And then you start to get the imbalance happening. Because then you start to say, well, okay, now everyone's paying 4% on every transaction. The stuff you buy has been through five levels or whatever. So you're back to paying 20, you know, whatever the aggregate of that is, over 20% as a cost of, you know, added to the cost of what you're buying. And so that becomes, potentially a disproportionate tax on people on lower incomes.
Again, it depends on how many transactions different social classes get involved in. Fundamentally, people who are workers have just got, you know, two major transactions. They get money in from their salary and they shop.
But it's what they're buying. How many? It's not them, is it? It's the stuff they buy. It's how many steps has been involved.
And then that comes to the vertical versus horizontal integration, which is another thing that sort of tax could change in the right direction, going back to vertical integration rather than horizontal. So, if it worked, it would have to have a huge impact overall, even though it's so small, because to make up for the same impact, if you want to have taxation, which say like comes at 30%, government spending is 33%, of GDP, then you need overall those transactions to sum to 30%, which is it's still going to have a large impact. And it would be, you know, that you could model this to some degree and have some sort of idea of what behavior is likely to be eliminated by it and so on, and see what the consequences are. But it would be a hell of a task bringing in this in properly without totally disturbing the system in the process.
Yeah. It's one of those things where... sounds like a great idea, but there are unintended consequences, and what are those? Very difficult to tell, but you can't phase it in that easily unless you did finance sector first, then everyone else after. But they are two very different things. And then do you do it just in one country? If you do it just in one country, then every business is going to say, well, okay, we've got lots of transactions involved in what we produce. We don't want to pay the aggregate of all of those in the UK or in the US, wherever you are. Let's outsource it all to somewhere where there isn't this transaction tax, and you're hit with that problem.
Or the opposite comes forward, because you get rid of a whole lot of deadwood in terms of your administration. You don't need your tax offices anymore. You don't need your tax department anymore, relatively speaking. So it could actually be a bonus to say this is an easier way to do business. And I am of the opinion, certainly I've now got the attitude that MMT has, the taxation is not there to raise revenue for the government. It's to take money out of circulation that's created. It's to maintain a positive balance in the Treasury's account at the central bank. Then you lose the moral imperative for taxation, and you come down to what is the more effective way to implement it to minimise the impact of government money creation. And this sounds, you know, to me very appealing. But if you wanted, you'd have to phase it in. So if you started off initially, you might start with a transaction tax of, say, 0.1% with income tax. And then as you increase the transaction tax, you reduce the income tax. I've got a feeling that'd be politically fairly popular for anybody brave enough to give it a try.
Although, you know, to do it, you'd be, I mean, this is would be an argument for digital currencies outright, wouldn't it? And and people don't like that idea. It's just feels as though there's too much control within the government. I mean, and yet, you know, the government controls this. I mean, we all have to pay income tax. I mean, you can avoid it by breaking the law. And maybe some people don't like the idea that this would you wouldn't be able to avoid this. But somehow perhaps it just feels a bit Big Brother.
Yeah, well, we live in a technologically dominated world, so and politically dominated as well. Mm. So Big Brother's already here, I think.
Okay. Well, yeah. And Tinium had talked about the idea about phasing it in while reducing income tax. I was thinking this is just an academic discussion. It can't work in practical terms, but maybe it can. And the obvious place to start, obviously, would be to start with a transaction tax for the finance sector.
Yeah, which you can argue is undertaxed at the moment and therefore deserves to be a target. But then, of course, you then see what the impact is. And it could be basically hand out the popcorn to the manufacturing sector to see what happens to the financial sector.
All right. Well, okay. Fantastic idea, Dr. Feige, but I'm not going to hold my breath in our lifetime. But who knows? I mean, the world has surprised us, hasn't it? And there's certainly, you just look at the way governments are funded right now and the need, I mean, getting back to how we started this discussion, they still need to raise tax revenue. They can't just create all money because it would flood the country with money. There's still got to be an element of taxation, and this would be quite a smart way of giving the government that control. So not only would we lose people working in the tax office, we wouldn't need many people working in the central bank, if indeed we needed a central bank at all.
I won't go there just yet, but yeah.
Right. Now, look, good. Before we go, a couple of messages I did say that we've got. Actually, we're starting to get a bit more feedback lately. This comes from Simon Jackson. He commented on Facebook. And picking up on my comment about the Japanese still being very productive, even though the economy is in a bit of a quagmire, he says Japan is not at all productive these days. It's ranked 30th out of 38 OECD countries, and most of the unproductive people are sitting in government offices doing busy work and making trouble for business people like me. I doubt paying down private debt will do much to free any domestic animal spirits within Japan. The domestic economy is too timid to try new things. Japan's technology reached its peak with the bullet train back in 64. Was that when it started? Wow, that was very forward thinking, wasn't it, back then? And it's gone backwards, or at least sideways, ever since. I'm surprised the country hasn't collapsed, but don't have much confidence in what will happen after the last of the Showa era people pass. I'm pretty sure there isn't a cohesive plan for handling population, but hope there is one. Thanks again very much for the podcast. And this from Rachel. I'm not a student of economics, and thus I do struggle to understand the more complex theories. Well, hopefully you've understood today's, Rachel. I think it was quite straightforward today. I've observed that the more complex the issue, the more excited and thus animated and fast-talking Steve becomes, making it even harder to grasp the concepts.
You're anyhow, just enjoying this because I'm getting the crit rather than you.
Well, this one, yeah. But Rachel, yeah. But the other one was having a go at me about Japan.
I know, yeah.
Anyway, that is not why I'm writing to you, but sometimes be mindful of it. What I really want to know is, are there any countries who do or have followed Steve's theories, models of managing an economy? That's from Rachel. Well, I guess it depends on what theory that we're talking about, doesn't it, really? But maybe I guess it's
I think we might find something in some government on Europa. And I mean the moon of Jupiter, not the country.
Not sure anyone lives there.
That follows my ideas. It's you know, I'm going to spend my life in the wilderness, it seems.
Right. Well, there we are. I'll be there with you some of the time, unless it's a bit uncomfortable, in which case I might desert you and lead a happy life. All right. Anyway, thanks, Rachel. Hopefully you understood today. And Steve's going to calm down from now on. I think you were fairly calm today, Steve. You didn't get too excited. So and it's not good for you at your age. So we'll catch you again next week. Thanks for listening in, everyone. We'll see you next week.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favourite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.